Hello everyone and welcome to The Hidden Lives of Writers. My name's Fiona Snickers and I'm joined by my co-host Gail Schimmel.
Hi Fiona, how are you doing this week?
I am doing pretty well. I think my mood is not reflective of how my writing is going.
Does that mean your writing's going badly?
It does indeed. That's maybe not completely true. So I'm still at the stage where my current manuscript is in a drawer and I'm not allowing myself to work on it actively.
Where are we in the countdown now?
There isn't a specific time limit. I'm trusting myself to know when it'll be the right time to go back and actually work on it. But I'm actively thinking about it and I'm taking a lesson from something that you said. I think you were also doing a big reread and rethink of a manuscript. And you reread your manuscript and you said to yourself, when last was I excited about something in that manuscript? And you went back and realized that it was at a point where you'd raised something that was going to be a red herring. And you thought, wait, no, that was exciting. I need to expand that. So I gave myself the same discipline. When in this manuscript did the wheel start to come off? When did I start to feel doubt about it? Mm-hmm. And I think it is after 60,000 words, something went wrong there. The last 20,000 it was really rattling down the hill, completely out of control. So at least I've identified the point at which I need to step in and redo things.
Very interesting. Very interesting. And so nice that something I said was useful.
I think our listeners would say that a lot of what you tell us is useful. So, Gail, how's your writing week going?
So I am still deep in the trenches of editing my group project. It's a more complex thing than I realized. You know, we've done a book, the four of us, before. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't the complex edit that it is now, because it wasn't a plot-driven book. So it wasn't so important that every strand comes together. So what happened is one of us did a lead edit and left comments for us, and now we're all going through and doing our bits. But as we're going through, we're reading each other's parts and now also having editorial input on each other's parts. So it's kind of it feels like it could be an endless circle of commenting, but we have agreed now that when we all are finished, we'll all go back and deal with the new things in our parts. So we'll see how it goes, but it feels at the moment a bit like I might be editing this book for the rest of my life.
So while you're working on this gigantic and possibly never-ending edit, Gail, what are you reading or watching or listening to?
So I decided I really needed to read something that I was looking forward to, like one of those authors that you just know you'll enjoy. And I read the new Dorothy Coomson. And it is called Give Him to Me. Mm-hmm. And as I started it, I got a bit confused because I thought I'd already read it. And I had to stop and go back and check my Kindle. And what it turned out is that she seems to be writing a series with the same characters. Mm-hmm. And she has this character who is a psychologist who has got caught up in working for a profiling part of the police services government. And she is stuck in that job for reasons that I believe were explained in the first book, but I cannot understand. So I cannot remember why she's stuck in the job. But she's stuck in the job. It's quite a toxic environment, but a case comes along that is very meaningful to her that she gets involved in. It's different from Dorothy Coomson's usual work because it's more plot-driven. Mm-hmm. It's more of a thriller/mystery. It has these ongoing characters, and now with this one, you get a sense we will see more. We will see what happens to her next. So it's a different read from her other books, but I loved it. She is so skilled. She's just such a clever, clever writer.
She is, and I look forward to that one.
What have you been reading?
Well, this is a bit of a funny one. You know, we're living in, let's say, interesting times at the moment, where there is just a fire hose of horrific news coming across one's screen every single day. You can't escape from it. So I've really had to go back into comfort reading.
Mm.
And I belong to a number of Facebook groups which are centered around nostalgia from my childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is an Enid Blyton fan group.
Okay.
And I've been reading these people who, I mean, some of them are a bit mad. They to this day read nothing but Enid Blyton as adults, you know, age 75 or whatever. And they talk about things like the Famous Five as though they are live and happening right now. Yes, it is a little bit mad, but I kind of got swept up into that world and I downloaded the first three Famous Five books and I've been reading them as a comfort read and as an exercise in nostalgia for myself. And it's just so interesting to think that of all the various banned books and banned authors, Enid Blyton is probably the one who's been most suppressed.
Oh, really? I didn't realize that.
Librarians, teachers, the BBC, they all refuse to stock her books, to do plays of her books, to do audio versions of her books, because they were believed to be too light, not challenging enough for children, and not raising enough moral issues. And I used to know this, and I'd forgotten it. And now I've been reading about it some more, and it really is honestly shocking. But the interesting thing is that, try as they might, they have not managed to suppress Enid Blyton. She still is one of the most published authors in the world to this day. And when I read The Famous Five, I remember why I loved it. I remember what good stories they were, how the characters were kind of archetypes that still work today. Okay. And it has distracted me from all the awfulness going on in the world. And I will shortly be getting back to adult reading. But it just has been so soothing and so comforting. So somebody who has really subverted my expectations of narrative in recent weeks is our guest today. Our guest today is Joanne Fedler. Joanne is the author of 15 books, unless I've miscounted, including When Hungry Eat, Secret Mother's Club, Unbecoming, Love in the Time of Contempt, and many more. Most recently, The Whale's Last Song, which is published by Mujaji Books to be distributed in South Africa. Joanne, thank you for your time and welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here in this funky studio with two amazing women writers.
Not as excited as we are, Joanne. I promise you that. Okay, we are going to get into it immediately. We are going to ask you, how was your writing week?
Well, there was a lot of jet lag involved. And on the few days that I managed to get to my journal, my little travel journal, I would say that it was probably not a great writing week for me. I am in sort of, you know, book promotion mode and my sister's 60th birthday mode. And we've also got my father's unveiling on Sunday. And so I find that there are times in life when you are doing things. And then there are times when you are holding and sitting with things and reflecting. And my best writing weeks are those quiet weeks, not when you're on the go. I try to be fastidious about checking in with myself and at least just having a felt body sense of where I am, especially when things are a bit tricky. There's a lot of input. I'm overstimulated. Writing sort of always seems to sort of just center me and bring me down. But I haven't been as able to do it in the last 10 days while I've been in South Africa.
I'm interested that you talked about journaling because I think it's the first time someone's mentioned journaling as part of their writing discipline.
Yes, and I know that it can be incredibly beneficial. Yeah. Can you tell us a bit about that?
When I think of my writing practice, for me, that's about doing something every day. Mm-hmm. And I don't work on projects every single day. You know, I write in a journal every day, and normally it would begin with me, if I can remember them, writing down my dreams and recording those, I'm absolutely fascinated in the role of the unconscious and the subconscious mind in the creative process. So I'm always writing my dreams down. And I don't have a very exciting life, as much as people might think otherwise. My life is really very, very small. I spend a lot of time on my own. I spend a little bit of time swimming. And so all the stuff that happens is really a kind of an internal, I don't think one would call it a monologue. I sometimes like to think it's a dialogue, but it's probably a monologue. But when I even teach writing, I always tell people that it's very important to have a journal in which you are tracking your writing project and your writing process. So writing about your writing, because that to me is one of the most fascinating engagements that we have. And I think it's where I have learned how to grow as a writer. I ask myself questions about my writing. I pose the problems that my writing is bringing up. I draw a little bit. I sketch a bit. I've started doing watercolors, which we can talk about when we talk about the creative process that was very unique around the Whale's Last Song. But for me, a writing practice is, you know, about checking in with all the different aspects of my existence, my life, because they feel like they all sort of like melt together. And then any writing project that I have is almost like on a good day when I sort of maybe catch like the tail of something that feels silvery or, you know, that shimmers in me, then I will think, okay, I'm going to use this and I'm going to go in and I'm going to work on that little piece, or I will focus on that. I mean, we know that in writing, you know, there are seasons, and if you're on a deadline, it's kind of different than if you're sort of just playing in the big ocean of creativity. You know, sometimes you have to be in a very narrow little pool and you're swimming up and down lanes and you're chasing deadlines. So I guess it just depends on where what you're working on, where you are in that writing process. Because I can be, so for example, like when I did the rewrite on the Whale's Last Song, I had 6 weeks to do it in, and I worked from like 8 in the morning till 6 at night with very few breaks, probably just like toilet breaks and a little swim. But that was like hyper focused, detailed, intentional writing. And I don't think that is sustainable. Mm. I don't think one can do that for very long. And then you need a real sort of like expansive break from that. But I wouldn't take a break from writing. I would still, in the time when I'm resting, I would still journal. I would still play with words. And I do a lot of, I have these little bundles, what I call these like treasure bundles, which are scraps that I don't ever throw anything away. Old magazines, cards, anything that arrives in the post. I cut them up into tiny little pieces and I turn them into little bundles. And then on any given day, especially when I'm feeling a bit flat and I sort of want to feel some sort of firing of uncommon neurons, I will just take a little treasure bundle, and based on an image or a word from different pieces, I will construct some little ridiculous, incomprehensible found poem. But sometimes, and not always, in that found poem, you put together a phrase or two or three little words, which are so, I call them like an igniting phrase, that just, it's just, you would never put those things together if you were consciously trying to use words in that way. And that sometimes can take me into writing a poem or even something I'm working on. It might just like stir me into a certain feeling about language. And I often feel like writing is just having that feeling in you, you know, that sort of loving feeling that you want to be in it. And I don't always feel that. And so I have to often play these little games with myself and trick myself into getting in the mood. Do you know what I mean? Sometimes you have to get in the mood for certain things. Mm. And I have these little tricks for doing that. Yeah.
That's so fascinating. Yeah. Can you talk us through when you're writing the first draft of something? So you're intentionally working every day, if that is how you do it. Can you break that down for us? What is your drafting of a first draft look like on a daily or hourly basis? Mm.
I probably wouldn't think that I am working on a first draft for starters, because I feel like that was how I did things in, I feel like I have these two eras of my life as a writer. The one was in those early days where I was so wanted to be a successful writer, and I was hell-bent on a certain understanding of what success meant, and I never wrote anything without having first a contract with a publisher. You know, all my books were pre-contracted, except for my very first novel, which was The Dreamcloth, which I worked on for 10 years. But after that, all my other books I had contracts with publishers for, not The Whale's Last Song. This was something completely and utterly different. And I feel like that era of my writing life was characterized and I think contaminated by wanting the writing to do something in the world. And I've realized that real artists, I'm just talking for myself, you know, this is not a judgment of anybody else, but real artists, or the way I understand real artistry, is about not sort of, as Mary Oliver would call it, having the voodoo of ambition interfere with what you are doing, what is trying to pulse its way through you. Because if you're over conscious about like where this is going and what it's going to do and excuse me, what it's got to look like, you start to worry about like who you're writing it for in the audience, and you know, is it going to hit its mark? So generally when I start in those days when I was writing a draft, I would be, and I am very disciplined because I'm a kind of a Virgo. I have, I think like five of my planets are in Virgo. So like I can be hyper-disciplined, hyper-focused, attention to detail. I've got what my father would call in Yiddish Sitzfleisch, which means I can sit for a long time and focus on something without taking a break. I can do it for a couple of hours and not stop doing that. I know some people struggle with that, but I can really do that. So when I was working to a first draft, I would sit down and I would, my first drafts were often messy. I'm not one of these people that plans things out ever, other than having sort of maybe like a big picture view of things. But at a certain point in the process, maybe when I've written around 40,000 words, which maybe we could say is like half a draft, mm-hmm. Then I would start thinking about structure, and then I would start working with index cards and looking at what I have, what's been gathering. Is there any, you know, where's this thing going? What is useful? What is not working? What is working? And then I would start planning the thing out. But for the first, and I would also use like dream boards. I would use vision boards. I love craft. I love craft and I love stationery, and I always try to find a way to bring that into the writing, you know? So, you know, I have a whole, like, you know, chest of drawers that is filled with old magazines. What you call your cokies in Australia, mm-hmm. They're called texters, different kinds of ones, paints, scissors, glues, all sorts of things. And I'm always looking for things that can, you know, be part of the process. So, I always have done vision boards for all my books, sometimes for characters. I use vision boards, and then I would work sort of methodically, through that to pull together a draft. I think my creative process has changed. The Whale's Last Song, it was a big rupture, from that person who wrote. I broke up with my writing. Like I had a proper divorce from my writing round about, what was it? I would say 2020-ish, round about COVID. I felt like my career took off very quickly, too soon, I would say, when I didn't actually appreciate the, you know, what success looked like. My second book, my first Australian book, Secret Mother's Business, got picked up in Germany. It had nothing to do with me. It had to do with my publisher. And it sold 500,000 copies and was like on the bestseller, the Der Spiegel bestseller list. And I thought to myself, oh, this is the start of a very successful career. And what that was my success. That was my success. Everything since then has been a very, you know, quite a very steep fall off a cliff. I did have some success with some of my other books that were picked up in Germany. For some reason, the Germans liked the books about motherhood, and even When Hungry Eat did really well there. But what happens in publishing houses is that the people that you work with, and I'm very much about relationships, the people that I work with, had such a beautiful publisher that I had a great relationship with. I went to Munich and I met her, and she was a big champion. And I can't actually overstate the importance of having people who are champions of your work, who believe in you. And she left that publishing house. And when she left, it was just very hard to place me. And the book that came out with somebody next didn't do well at all. And it was quite a disaster, really. And then she left. And now my book there's nobody there who even wants my book, this new book, The Whale's Last Song. I think my agent has tried. And so, you know, I gave up that idea of success, and I thought to myself, I've actually been a failure. I had this idea after my mother passed away that I'd sort of been a failure. Like if my success hadn't worked on a graph that was, you know, working in a certain way, that I'd been a failure. And I decided that there were so many terrible things going on in the world. Who was I to sit around in front of a computer and do my little found poems on a good day? There were serious issues that needed attending to, like climate change. And I'd been doing ocean swimming, and I was very in love with the ocean, and I support lots of marine organizations and Sea Shepherd and all of these things. And I had been doing a lot of research on seaweed, and I decided I was going to work for a seaweed company that produces food. Yeah. That produces food.
Did not see that one coming.
I know. That produces food that they feed to cattle that stops them producing methane. I thought it was a good idea at the time. It sounded like a cutting edge idea. And I did it for 6 weeks, and I realized it was a form of greenwashing, and I really realized that I am absolutely unemployable. Like, I cannot work for somebody. It was a very male-dominated environment, and what I saw there was just really, it made me terribly unhappy. And I had made this big announcement to all of my readers that I'm sorry, I'm giving up writing, and I'm going to work in a seaweed company. And I'll see you on the other side of climate.
I'm sorry, but the sentence is so funny.
I was very obsessed
to work in seaweed.
Listen, Gail, seaweed is miraculous stuff. I just want you to know. It really is. And I was, you know, they had all these ideas about what one could do with seaweed to just like fix the world. I just had this feeling like, oh, how am I actually going to take my skills and fix the world? I have to tell you, during COVID, I got very cross with myself that I hadn't done biology and like decided that I was going to be a pandemiologist because someday we were going to need a vaccine or something. I just thought, what a waste of a brain. Like, why did I decide to do, you know, go follow this path? I've had you can see big life moments, in the last couple of years. And so I gave up writing. And when I began writing, when I just wanted to write, my little girl was very young. She was just a few months old, and we traveled to the Transkei, my husband and I, and we found a guy who was selling walking sticks on the side of the road, beautiful handcrafted walking sticks, and there's one of a woman holding a book to her chest. I assume it was a Bible, but I took it as a book, and I bought this walking stick, and it stood above my desk, and I called her the woman of the book. And she was my totem, and she stood and looked over me while I wrote. And when I broke up with my writing, I decided I needed to do a ritual that was going to, you know, be like a serious declaration to the universe that I was serious, that I'm giving up writing. I realized that I haven't been successful, and it's over. And I looked around, and I saw this walking stick, and I knew that this was the one thing that represented everything that I wanted for my life, and that I had to give this thing up. And I stood on the side of a cliff, and with tears streaming down my eyes, I threw her into the ocean.
That's so sad.
I thought she was going to be burnt.
Well, I thought of burying her, but then I think you can always exhume something like that when you change your mind. And I realized that I didn't want to give myself any way of like retrieving this because it was over. I had to accept that.
Except that you set her free. You didn't destroy her.
No, I didn't want to destroy her. I wanted to
destroy her.
Give her to the ocean. And I did. And that, that was the end of my writing. And after my mother died, I sank deeper and deeper into this conviction that writing was definitely a waste of time. But then something happened during my grief, and the Whale's Last Song is the result of that.
There's so much there. I'm relating to so much of this. Okay. You've talked about, as you've been talking now, you kind of stop at a point. You don't take us back further than the beginning of the writing. I want you to take us back a little bit further and tell us your origin story. And I know I'm always particularly interested in yours because we share a lot of our path. We're both lawyers. I think you possibly a much better lawyer than me. But tell us where you started and how that came to writing.
Like from when I was a little girl.
If you want to tell us whether Little Joanne wrote, we're very interested in whether you wrote as a child or not.
Well, I think I always wrote. I started writing as soon as I could form letters. I started writing stories. The very first story, was about a little girl who goes on a picnic. And also I illustrated that story. It was called Goodbye Kitchen. And, I wrote a crime thriller about Ned and his wife who gets killed. And then he has to go and find the person who's killed her. I mean, I didn't get very far on that because I had no idea how these things worked, but I always read and I wrote and I loved stories and I loved Enid Blyton. I know it's so, because I had a father who was such a creative force, I knew that from a blank piece of paper, you could create a world, and that world existed inside of you. It was not from outside. And he always encouraged that. And I always, loved that aspect of, the world that I lived in, inside the home that we lived in, which I think was probably quite unusual compared to other people's homes. My father was a big child. He had like a playroom, a studio, which was just...
I think perhaps in case any of our listeners don't know, explain who your father was.
Okay. My dad was Dorf Fedler. He was a political cartoonist for the Star for about 50 years, but he was also, a sculptor and he made puppets and he made movies and he was a wonderful writer, particularly in the last, I'd say, 15 years of his life, which I had a big role in helping him and supporting him with. But he was just a kind of like a creative genius. Honestly, I can say that. Like, he was a very, very talented, creative person. And so growing up in that home, there was just, a lot of sort of quite heavy things. We didn't have an easy home. But it was a very creative home, and being around somebody like that who is sort of so exuberantly creative is very inspiring. The idea that you should paint or that you should make a poem and you should do all these things. I think in a lot of households, these things are not regarded as worthwhile endeavors. But my father, when I was 14, gave me a copy of Dylan Thomas's book Under Milkwood, A Play for Voices, and he said, read this. I think he was very upset that I kept dieting, thinking that somehow dieting was going to make me happy or was part of my life's work. He just said, you're never going to be a model, Joanne. You're going to be other things. And he gave me this book, and I read this thing, and I honestly, it was that feeling that I had inside of me of reading something I suppose one can only describe it as like maybe when you kiss somebody that you've wanted to kiss, and that feeling inside of you where everything explodes. It was it was like an arousal, like a kind of like a creative arousal of like, you could do this thing with language. And I knew from that moment that that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to do this sort of thing with words. And so my father definitely was the person who set me on this path. He was a huge influence on me, and we shared a great love of writing, and we would, up until he died recently, just a couple of weeks ago, you know, we would speak every day, and very often our conversations were about what he'd read or his dreams or what we were thinking or what poetry we'd read. There were always creative conversations about movies or books or anything like that. So my whole life has sort of been the foundations of all of that were really part of me, really deeply part of me. And what I want to say as well is that my mother, though she was a scientist and a doctor, was also a very creative person, kind of withheld in a lot of ways because she'd wanted to be an occupational therapist. And her father said, no, if you are going to do medicine, you should be the one giving the orders. And so he said she should become a doctor. But as a child, she painted and drew and was like a fashion designer. I've got a collection of like 500 little outfits she made for paper dolls that are just like works of art that I still want to figure out what to do with. So I feel like, and my father's mother was a poet. So I think that there were just lots of like creative energies and forces around me. And when I went to university, I did law and I did English, and I loved them both. One for what the English, for what it did for me inside, and the law for what I felt that it could possibly do for the country I was living in, for the issues that we were facing. And then when I finished my BA, I was at a crossroads of either doing honors in English or going on to do an LLB. And I chose to do an LLB because it felt like that was the right thing to do. It was about doing something that wasn't just made me feel good. I didn't see myself as like an English lecturer or anything like that. I felt like I wanted to be more like Ruth Bader Ginsburg or somebody like that, make a difference. And so I did law, and my life was law for a while, and I wasn't a very good lawyer, Gail. I just want to tell you. In fact, one of my professors said to me once that, Ms. Fedler, you have the brains to be a brilliant lawyer, but not the heart.
I can vouch for that one, that you were a very good lecturer. You can't argue. You can tell me you were a bad lawyer, but you can't tell me you were a bad lecturer because you lectured me. And you know this?
I didn't know that I lectured you.
I kept it secret because I didn't come and go, oh, Joanne, our families are friends. Like, here I am. Because my main aim in life was to fly it below the radar.
Wow.
But the lecture I remember most.
And look at you now.
Yeah. Yeah. Something happened. I don't really know what. The lecture I remember most is you did a lecture on gender and law. And you were teaching us about prostitution. And it was the evening. And we were all itching to leave because it was the evening. And you got to the last 10 minutes of the lecture and you went, okay, now you guys have noticed there's someone sitting in the front. There'd been a man sitting in the front. And you went, this is so-and-so. He's a sex worker. He's going to talk to you now. And suddenly none of us wanted to go anywhere. And we were there and listening. And that is the lecture that stands out of my LLB.
Wow. So thank you, Gail. Well, listen, I can say this. I loved lecturing. I love teaching. And I love teaching writing now. It's to me that there is so much joy in that communion of helping people to understand things in ways that are complex and that grapple with material, you know, and that don't offer sort of easy answers that just, you know, fit into neat little holes. I love it when people are grappling with things. And I think writing is a perfect place for people to grapple with with the impossible conundrums of how to say something that is true.
That leads nicely into my next question, which is, what would you, the Joanne who's sitting here today, say to someone who came to you and said, writing work has no value, we should all be working on solving climate change. There is no value in this thing of writing. What would you say to that person now?
I can't tell you that that is true for you or for me. That felt true for me for a time, and I encourage you to live by that for a little while and go and do the thing that you think is going to make the big difference in this world. Give it your everything. Hold nothing back. Bury your writing. Throw your writing wand into the ocean. Divorce it. Cut yourself off from that part of yourself. And let's have a conversation in 5 years' time. Let's look at your mental health. Let's look at your spiritual health. Let's look at the, you know, let's grapple with this idea. Is that true? Because I think what is true for any one person at any one time in their lives might change. And I think, you know, when we're young, we really do think in these absolutes, and we think that this is going to be true for me forever. I mean, you know, we marry people, for goodness sake. We say, I'm going to love you forever. I have to say that I do believe that is possible, but I think what you mean by that changes. And if you can't, you know, be the person who keeps coming back to asking ourselves, what do I mean by that? What does that look like for where we are now? And have things changed? You know, I just think that this idea of being flexible with the things that we are so certain about is really, really important. It's part of what being human is about, is that we question our own, like, certainties. I'm not certain about anything, Fiona, at all anymore, like I was when I was younger. I really thought I knew things, and I realize now how little I understood about anything. But I also think that it is a developmental right to think that you know the answers to life and to then give it your everything. And hopefully one has the second chance and the humility to maybe come back and wonder, you know, was that true? And I think if anybody has that longing to write, that you can try and, you know, talk yourself out of it, and you can make negotiations with it, and you can banish it, and you can do all sorts of things. And I think eventually it comes back, and it's asking something of you. I think that there is something about accepting your fate rather than pursuing some goal that has sort of been planted in us, partly by the expectations maybe in our families and the roles that we played, partly by the society we live in and the ideas of what being successful looks like in that society. And so we go for it with, like, conscious purpose. But there, I've accepted my fate, which is that I have to write. And I think The Whale's Last Song has been a kind of an affirmation for me that this is something I need to do, because it is so unusual in my genre. It is so unexpected. It sort of came from a place I don't know, really. It feels like it was a bit of a surprise. I can't really explain it. When people ask me, I can try and explain it, but I honestly really don't know. And I kind of want to go back into the place that came from, which was I had no expectations about this. I wrote it for myself while I was grieving the death of my mother. I thought I was writing a child's book. I thought I was writing a book for children, because I was writing it for I felt like a 5-year-old who'd lost her mother. And I was writing it for that little 5-year-old girl in me that had lost her mother. And because I'm obsessed with the ocean and I love whales, and I was playing in the space of listening to whale song and swimming and feeling part of the whole world, I just wanted to say something about that. And I wanted to write something short. I didn't want to say something long. And I wanted it to be beautiful. I wanted every word to be beautiful. I wanted it to be like sort of like a longish poem. And it just leapt out of me, literally like a whale jumps out of the ocean, you know, in a kind of inexplicable way. And I'm so grateful for it, because it reset something in me that I just want to do. When I wrote this book, I just said, I just want to fall back in love with language again, like I was when I was 14 and my father gave me under Milkwood. I just want to feel that thing again. And I did. I did. While I was writing that book, I was kind of enraptured. Mm. I was excited. I loved writing these characters. I felt like it took me into such a different place. And I didn't know if anyone would be interested in this book when it was finished. Mm. You know, it just was, I wrote the whole thing not knowing if I could even show it to anyone. And the responses I've had from this book have just been unlike anything I've ever received from any of my other books. So, one has to be careful not to want to now replicate that, yeah. You know, even though I have written about 40,000 words of another book, which is in a similar style. I'd sort of been working on both of these things at the same time, but this one then sort of took over. So I do want to finish that other one too.
I want to take a step back before we get into the creation of The Whale's Last Song. And I know we've both got a lot of questions about that. I want to talk about your writing. In my head is divided into two main streams, your kind of fictionalized memoirs and then your fiction. And there are other things, other projects in between and a bit of poetry. And, but those of your books that you kind of, those are the two main streams. The fictionalized memoirs, talk to us about that, how you came to those books and the role it serves in your life.
Hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, I think for me, it started with Secret Mother's Business. Yes. And it really came out of, you know, just grappling with motherhood and wanting to say something real and true and complex about motherhood. And I did it with, you know, these lots of different characters all sort of speaking in different ways about motherhood. And it really was based on an evening that I spent with a group of girlfriends when we all had little children. And because that was so successful, also because I think it went into sort of the taboo areas, which I'm always interested in as well, the shadow stuff, saying the thing you think you can't say. And it is also sort of based really on that feminist idea that women's lives and the complexities of women's lives are really interesting. And that there is a kind of like a feminist aspect mm-hmm. of it, which is like the truth telling, the storytelling of women's lives. And so then I went on to, you know, 7 years later, write about, you know, having children who are tweens in the reunion. And then, a couple of years later, The Unbecoming, which is like the empty nest and, you know, where women find ourselves. But I also wrote Love in the Time of Contempt, mm. which was not a self-help book, but it was about raising teenagers. And I have found like the material of my life. And also I wrote When Hungry Eat, which was about immigrating and trying to lose weight and trying to, you know, make peace with where I was. Because I suppose I journal a lot, and so the internal life is sort of quite interesting to me, the way we grapple, and also understanding too that whatever I'm grappling with has a resonance for other people. I think this is the thing that a lot of writers who write personal narrative or memoir struggle with. Who will be interested in anything that I have to say? And this is, I have to tell you, like 90% of the mentoring I do is to really get women to believe that what their lives is bringing up is more than interesting enough. You don't have to go to the Antarctic or, you know, have some terrible thing happen to you for you to write something interesting. And I think, you know, Jung has been a great influence on me because he believed that our memories and our dreams, that these were the things that were interesting and important, not the places you visited, not the things that have happened to you, but the meaning that you make of even the most mundane thing that happens to you. I mean, Mary Oliver spent her entire career writing about moss and rocks and nature. And, oh my God, imagine what the world would be without Mary Oliver's poetry, right? You don't have to have these major things happen to you for your stuff to be interesting. So I did a lot of that writing, and I have actually also just finished a memoir about my mother's death during COVID called Bring Us Home to Sorrow, which, is with my agent now. It's a kind of like a companion book in a way to The Whale's Last Song. The Whale's Last Song maybe is like the myth, and this is more like the memoir of it. And I think when we write memoir, we're always worried that it's going to just not be that interesting. But it's all in the writing, and that's the thing that I always say to people is that you have to focus on your craft when you're writing memoir more than anything, the craft is the most important thing. And you can only take your readers as deep as you have gone. So you, how deep have you gone? How deep have you grappled with this experience? Because you must be saying something interesting about it, something that is yours, not an echo of something else, but what you have made of that life experience. And only you can make something interesting of it, because all the threads that have brought you into that moment, like the fact that your father played the bagpipes and you grew up, you know, in KwaZulu-Natal or whatever it is, all those things are woven into it. So what meaning have you made of it? And if you make it so particularly personal, you will always be touching on a universal truth that will be a bridge into someone else's experience. And I've experienced this enough times now with all my very personal stuff. And people have said to me, oh my God, I felt like you were writing my story, even though I have not immigrated. This has not happened to me. That's not happened to me. Because people don't understand that really we're all just writing about the same themes. And we're just using different details.
Fiona, did you pick up there that the woman who gave up writing went on to work on three projects at once? Did you pick up that little thing? Because there's the book, and then the book that actually she was working on at the same time, but the Whale's Last Song took over. And then there's a memoir that just popped at us out of nowhere.
Well, boom, no, you'll tell you why. Because, Gail, I was keeping a journal when my mother was sick. I actually started writing notes to my letters to my mother when she was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. These were like, it was like a journal, but they were letters to her. And I just tracked this experience. Everything that happened and all the feelings, And then she died, and I tracked that grief, and I carried on tracking all of that for like a year. And then I just left that. And that was like journaling, right? Those were like journaling. And then I came back into it. And that's a very important part of, I think, memoir, is coming back into an experience when you have some perspective so that you can create a container that holds this thing. Because that's when you have the perspective of what you're dealing with. And really what I came to understand was that this book was about distance, and the distance that happens from immigration, COVID, illness, and finally death. And how we navigate all of those things. I mean, I could only say this now because I've just finished writing a proposal for my agent where I had to look at what I had done. And, so there was the journaling, there was the writing of it, and I really focused on the writing. I wanted the writing to be rich and beautiful and painful and truthful. And I'm really happy with that. But I'm, again, like in the market that we're in, memoir is not a big seller. If you're not a big celebrity, it's very hard to sell. I might have to just put it out on my Substack chapter by chapter. We'll see how things go. The market is a different thing, and it's a different story, and you can't worry about that while you are working on something that is meaningful to you. And I think, honestly, that would be the thing that I would say to writers, is that you must work on the thing that is meaningful to you and will make meaning of your life.
Because writing is a lonely business. It can be a boring business. It can be repetitive. And it sounds like in the early part of your career, the fuel that made you sit down and do it was this hunger to succeed, to be a successful, recognized writer. What is the fuel now? What keeps you bum in seat? What keeps you going?
It's such a beautiful question. It just feels like a kind of a yearning to touch this like mysterious place again, you know, to feel the joy of this gift, because we don't always think of it as a gift. Like, as you say, it can be drudge, and we don't get paid enough for what we do, and we can get so down on ourselves around the practicalities of writing. But honestly, it is, you know, if you look at a dancer dancing, a painter painting, it's not as romantic as watching a writer write. But, I mean, you know that feeling inside yourself when you've written just one beautiful phrase or sentence. Like, it's very hard to describe to somebody else. It feels sort of like so self-congratulatory, but it's not. It just feels like you've sort of like laid a track somewhere out there, especially if somebody else will get to read it, that somebody will go, oh, you know, that just holds that experience for me. That says the thing that I want, that I've not been able to express. It's like that unspoken thing that you've just kind of held for somebody for a moment. And I feel that that is the way that we, you know, that we stay connected, and we have to be so, robust, because we, until somebody maybe reaches out to us or emails us or lets us know, we actually have no idea how this thing has landed. We don't get the applause of a rock star or, you know, or a performer or anything like that. This is like a non-performative thing in a lot of ways, you know. It is for the quieter. And I've realized actually, as much as my sort of persona is maybe one of an extrovert, that I am a deep introvert. I need a lot of solitude, a lot of alone time. That's, I think, why I love swimming, because nobody can get hold of me. Nobody talks to me. I can wave at the fish and the cuttlefish, and I am the most happy when I'm there, and I feel the most connected when I'm out there. But I think, you know, Fiona, it's it's also hard work, is to stay in relationship with your writing is probably the hardest thing. It's the thing that I try to teach my writers. That's why I think the journaling is important, is because you need to stay in relationship with your writing. You have to stay connected to it. You have to keep asking yourself, why am I doing this? Is it still bringing me joy? If not, could I work on something that will bring me joy? And I feel like for myself, what I really needed to do was to connect with a kind of playfulness around my writing that I never had. It was always sort of like, as you say, very focused, very goal-oriented. And I want to have softer edges around that. I want to be more receptive to it maybe not landing anywhere. You know, some of the most incredible, the people that I most admire are these people who just head down, focus on the task that they've been given. And I like to look at artists as well as other creatives. I'm very interested in lots of people's creative process, not just writers, though I think for writers it is a very specific thing. It's not collaborative often until you have a wonderful editor to work with. It's not, you don't get that sort of buzz that you, that other creative people seem to get. My daughter works in theater, and I just see how much joy comes from that collaborative process, which you don't, one doesn't have as a writer. But even just like the opportunity, like today, to sit and talk to other people who just nodding when I'm talking, you know, makes me like feel like not such a freak, you know, like, you know what I'm saying, you understand what, you know, and that's why I love teaching, is because, you do get to create these little communities of people that understand. And that's why sometimes it's nice just to get together with someone and sit and write together, even if you don't talk, but you're just, you know, sharing that, that space together and encouraging each other, which we all really need to do.
Joanne, you've touched on it, and something that Fiona and I are both very interested in is that you had to turn this book from a children's book into a novel. Just talk us through that, because we can't imagine.
You see, you understand that when I got this email back from HarperCollins saying, we love this book, we love it, but it's not a children's book. This is a book for an adult market, and we want to market to an adult market, and it's more like The Little Prince, and it's more like, you know, The Princess Bride and this sort of thing, that it was not just a question of adding, you know, boobs and mentions of sex and, you know, making, you know, they're not, these are not small changes. Like, the whole thing had to be reconceived, especially for her, my wonderful, wonderful publisher, Catherine Mullen at HarperCollins. She said that I had made the evil marquee was a cartoon, and evil is not a cartoon. It is a very serious thing. And I had to take the evil in the story seriously. So with that as the foundation, like, what it would mean to have like serious evil in the world. And I think what we're looking at in the world right now, that's right. She said, this is a book for our time. Mm-hmm. It's a book for what's happening now. And could you hold that? And I have to say, I mean, The Evil Marquis was based on Joseph Goebbels, who was a philologist and a manipulator of language. And he understood that you could manipulate people with language. I mean, if one has to go back to that wonderful question you asked, Fiona, about somebody who says, you know, why is writing important? I mean, if we think about how much of the world takes place in words, on Twitter and on social media and the way people use language and the way people manipulate language, I would say that if we really focused on how we use language, we might actually have a kind of a better place in the world. You know, the world would be a better place. So I had to go back and really make this person evil. But when you think about, you know, what is evil, and you're thinking about it in a complex way, you understand that evil doesn't just arise from nowhere. Evil takes place in a society. It takes place in a context. And the story takes place in medieval Spain, you know, during the bubonic plague. And there are also witch hunts. And so there is genuine, like, there is genuine stuff going on there. But I sort of was making it palatable for a children's audience. So then I really went back and I looked at if these things were serious, like through lines in the story, like how that would really play out. So then you really are looking at the anxiety of a father who is bringing up a child that he's terrified might, you know, might be called a witch. How would you protect that person? And then how would his psychology change? The complexity of each character, you know, had to start to have these real depths. And I'm so glad she made me go back and do it, even though it really was very, very hard and difficult, but extraordinary. I mean, in the sense that it was like being in a pressure cooker. It was like a little piece of corn kernel that popped into this like little fluffy popcorn, which I always think is still amazing. I still can't understand the popcorn. I'm still always amazed by that. But I mean, it really was like to reconceive. The story was still the same, but the complexity, the depth, and the, you know, the subtleties and the implications of everything were more complex. And I think it made all the characters deeper, richer. And I just fell more and more in love with each of them as I went into it. I mean, maybe trying to do it as a children's story was a kind of a lazy option. But honestly, the reason I'd started writing The Whale's Last Song is that while I was grieving my mother, I couldn't write and I couldn't read. I couldn't concentrate. And I'd read Ann Patchett's beautiful book of essays, These Precious Days. And in it, she has a chapter about this children's author, Kate DiCamillo, who I'd never heard of. And she has this gorgeous chapter about all of her books, and I felt like I could read children's stories. And I bought all of Kate DiCamillo's books and I read them all one after the other. And the one I fell mostly in love with was called The Magician's Elephant. And while I read that, I had that same feeling in me that I had when I'd read Dylan Thomas, and something started to stir. I finished that book and I got up and I went to my computer and I just saw this little girl. She was running through the cobbled street. She was on a mission. I didn't know what yet. And I saw she had a note in her hand and I didn't know what was on the note yet. And in her other hand, she had, a fork. And I thought, okay, these two things I have to resolve. I don't know why she's holding these things. I don't know what she's doing with them, but she's got to go somewhere and it's very important and it's urgent and there's big stakes here. And so the story began to like form in my head. Yeah.
The hairs on my arm stood up when you talked about that. That starting with an image. I'm always very interested in writers who do that, who start with an image and from an image a story grows.
It's never happened to me before, Gail. It never happened to me before. And I think it was just really just because I was so undefended after my mother died. Literally, that's one of the things I write about a lot in my memoir. I literally felt undefended, like all the things in front of me had fallen away and I was just open, like I was just open, very suggestible, I suppose. And then I just saw this little girl and she was trying to save someone she loved. And I guess in my psyche, you know, if you track your dreams and you look back at things, you know, I'd wanted to save my mother. We all want to save the people that we love. And she was trying to save someone that she loved. And so I was using that story as a way of saying something about what happens when somebody you love is sick. Teo's sister, Sanchia, is sick with a pox, or she thinks is the pox, and she's got to find a cure for her. And that's what her mission is. She's got to go find a cure. And, you know, when somebody you love is sick, you will do anything. You will imperil yourself. You will give up a kidney. You will have a bone marrow, give your bone marrow. You will do whatever it takes to try and save the person that you love. And that's in the real world. But in a story, you can send a child off into the forest, send her down to the ocean.
Carrying a fork.
Carrying a fork.
and a note.
And a note. Yeah. And there were lots of ways those two things could go, because I had to keep asking myself in my journaling, why is she carrying a fork? Where does the fork come from? And then when I did all my research, like, there weren't really – forks were not a big thing in medieval times. Like, only – royalty had forks. So then I knew that the fork had to have come from somewhere far away in the ocean. And so all these, you know how it is when you write, these pieces start to, like, you know, weave themselves together. And I had lots and lots of drawings and things about, you know, what was on the note? Who was the note from? Where was the note going? What, you know, would she, did she know what was on the note? So these things are really, you know, when you're writing and you don't know where it's going, it's kind of exciting. And I'd really never had that sort of thrill before in writing. I sort of always sort of knew kind of where things were going. Often, you know, some of the insights that happened in the writing were always interesting. But especially, you know, in the memoir stuff, but in fiction, you can really just like let it all go and just see where it carries you. I wanted this to, I didn't know I had it in me to be frolicsome, which felt like this book sort of had that, wanted it to have that sort of feeling, but also to have that very, that deep undercurrent or that bass note that, like, it's a serious book in some ways. It's quite a serious book. It's trying to say something serious, but also light and joyous.
Well, we've talked about the fuel that keeps you going, but let's talk about another kind of fuel. What do you, Joanne, read or listen to or watch to fill up your creative well? Whose creativity do you consume or have you been consuming lately?
Yeah. Fiona, I don't watch a lot of TV. I have to say, and I'm not judging people who do. While I've been here in South Africa, I do watch Netflix because my brain, you know, just needs to switch off. So when I want to switch off, I do watch TV, but I'm quite serious about my downtime. So, like, I have, like, I probably read mostly. That's what I consume. I read. I buy books every week, and I have probably 40 books next to my bed. So every night when I get into bed, I will look at them and I'll think, am I in the mood for poetry? Am I in the mood for psychology? Am I in the mood for, you know, fantasy. So I have lots and lots and lots and lots of books next to my bed. Some about even the writing process. I actually find that quite relaxing. I read a lot of books about writing and about, and I also love diaries. Like, I love diaries of artists and Anais Nin and all these people who kept diaries. I love reading diaries. Mae Sarton's journals I adore. I find them very relaxing and, strangely, they do fuel me. And at the moment, I've been a bit obsessed with Ursula Le Guin. I've been reading, a lot of her books, and she wrote in so many different ways and genres, but, her books about the craft, her essays, you know, her fantasy stuff, the Earthsea stuff. I've really been going back to, writers who take writing very, very seriously. I'm trying to take myself in some strange way, more seriously as a writer, because I think I've accepted that I'm a writer now. And so therefore, I have to really honor the craft of it and just try to become a better writer. With everything that I write, I want to become a better writer. And I want to be able to teach writing better. You know, every time I teach, I understand writing differently. I learn a lot from students, and I also edit a lot of people's writing as well. So I get a lot of fuel from all of that. I've been reading a lot of sort of fairy tale stuff and a lot of stuff about enchantment and about grief and about, you know, these sorts of things. I read a lot of poetry. I read poetry every day. I've got a huge collection of poetry, and, you know, one can read and reread and reread and read. I'm reading a lot of William Stafford at the moment, for some reason. I go through phases, you know, Billy Collins and Ada Limon. And I often just pick up books, my poetry books, and just will dip in and out of them as a way of also just doing that thing of just arousing oneself. It's like, you know, it's like the writer version of porn, you know, you just read a little bit of poetry and see what gets stirred in you. So, I mean, I think that's really what I do. I don't think it's a process as much as kind of like a messiness. It's like I'm kind of greedy. I just want to just take in as much as I can of lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of different things. Because I think the World's Last Song, it feels like a braiding of so many different strands of thought and philosophy and thinking and poetry and lots of thinking and reading. I mean, oh, there's such an amazing writer called Niall Williams. Have you heard of Niall Williams? He's an Irish writer. I've been consuming his books. He's got beautiful books. One called This Is Happiness. Another one called History of the Rain. And that book, another one is called Four Letters of Love. He is an extraordinary, beautiful writer. Actually, I would say that I've been consuming lots of his writing. I didn't love his most recent book called Time of the Child or something like that. But there's a line in History of the Rain in which it says something like, every book is woven from many different other books. Like every single thing that arrives like this is the product of, I mean, you could almost see it's like the product of lots of cross-pollinations of DNA, like literary DNA. Everything I've read, everything I've thought, everything I've felt is inside the Whale's Last Song. Everything. I mean, it's quite an amazing thing to think that, and I'm sure that, and I think that's true of everything, unless one is sort of hyper-focused on a very sort of like, you know, obscure area where one's focusing on one thing. But I think if one brings one's whole psyche in, including your dreams and your family and your history and your reading and your writing and all these tiny little, even if they are hidden within the text, like subterranean within it, it's all inside there. I think that's such a beautiful idea that so nothing goes to waste. And in a way, that is the whole metaphor of the Whale's Last Song, is the central image of whale fall, which is when a whale dies in the ocean and it sinks slowly through the fathoms and every single part of the whale goes and feeds and feeds and feeds and feeds millions and millions and gazillions of creatures. Nothing of the whale goes to waste. I love that idea of if we live in that conscious way, that nothing goes to waste. Like we use everything. We can use everything, you know, if we're open and we just let it all sort of, you know, color us and fill us and we bring it all to the writing. You know, if we've shut parts of ourselves away and not accessing parts of it, then you can't bring it all. But if you open all those valves and you just like let it whoosh through you, it just arrives, you know, on the page. And how beautiful is that? I mean, it's quite a gift, isn't it, that we can do that. I don't know how many people in their work get to bring all of that, you know, into their work, you know, to their whole lives on the page, you know.
Well, I keep wanting to call it the whale's last fall because I'm so mesmerized by that image of a whale falling. But it is a magnificent book. Gail and I both absolutely loved it. It's a fable for adults with real characters, with real stakes and a real story.
Thank you.
And we enjoyed it so much. And we hope that everybody will buy this book because it feels like such a necessary book for this time.
If everyone needs to read it, it's so beautiful. It just is so, the language, I wanted to have a whole conversation about the language. The language is so beautiful. And I'm not normally a language person. So everyone go out and buy it.
This is so true. Joanne, thank you so much for your time. We are so grateful to have had you in the studio today.
I can't tell you what a joy and gift and pleasure it was to have this time with you to talk about it. I think this is one of those serendipities and unexpected gifts that you get as a writer, is to just talk about the thing that you've done. And with two such beautiful, creative, intelligent writers, it's just been such a joy. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Gail, I don't know when I've ever been so inspired by a guest before.
I want to run home and write, and the fact that I cannot is making me want to cry.
You can just see that she is an incredible writing teacher. This is why people flock to have her as a mentor, to have her as a writing teacher, because she is so incredibly inspiring.
Absolutely. There was so much. I mean, I kept writing little notes down. I kept thinking, I must remember this. I must learn from this. There's so much to unpack. I don't even know where we start. Do you have a starting point for us?
I've also got an absolute forest of notes, but I think where I want to start is she talked about writing vision boards for her characters.
Yes.
And it reminded me of some of our previous guests, especially Carnita Loxton talked about creating a vision board for her own coming year and then used that as a starting point for a novel. Her character does that. And it's just this visual angle. Like Joanne also talked about when she was a child, she would write stories and illustrate them. And my children also did that. But I only ever wrote stories. I never felt that urge to illustrate. And I know I'm not a visual person. I don't operate kind of in that visual sphere. I can't draw. It's that illustrative world is kind of cut off to me. But maybe that's why it's so fascinating to me. This idea of different streams of creativity, using all five of your senses to feed your creativity. I don't know if it's a path for me, but I find it very, very interesting.
And I'm interested in what you're saying because I do have that side of me. I do draw, but I never illustrated my stories either. And I don't draw directly as part of my creative process, but if I'm stuck, drawing can unstick me. So it feeds into the same creative energy. And I've actually got a little drawing over my desk at the moment. And I've written next to it, creativity begets creativity. So I'm feeling, if I'm feeling stuck in writing and I go and draw, it loosens something up. And being creative is, like she talked about, part of one big pot for me. But I don't bring them together. And every now and then I try to. Like, I don't know how, if you remember how excited I got when we spoke to Alex Latimer. And I suddenly thought I was going to be illustrating children's stories for the rest of my life. I try and it wears off. I drew a bat and that was that. It was a great bat, but that was that. So, yeah, it's very interesting. And in this book that she's brought it together, there are drawings in this book.
Yes, it's very beautifully illustrated. And the cover is an actual work of art. People need to see it.
Beautiful.
And what did you take from what Joanne said?
I want to talk about two things. I'm going to talk about one, and then the other one relates to the advice and a realization I had recently. But she spoke about the voodoo of ambition and how she is pleased to be released from the voodoo of ambition. Fiona, I think you and I both suffer from the voodoo of ambition. I mean, I actually found myself describing myself to someone the other day in terms of my writing, and it's quite an odd phrase to use about yourself because it's quite self-pat on the back, but I feel I'm audaciously ambitious about my writing. Like, I don't see anything that I can't at least try to achieve.
Right, right. And
now I'm like, is that holding me back, maybe? Yeah. I'm not sure. What do you think?
I also still have this very, very active hunger to succeed. And for my, I can't conceive of a ceiling for my writing. I just want it to go further and further. I want to do better and better. And that's why I asked Joanne, without that fuel, what fuel remains? Because I almost can't quite imagine it. But at the same time, I know that even if I knew for a fact that I'd never be published again, I would continue to write. It's a kind of compulsion for me. And I think you feel the same way. Am I right?
I do. I do. And this is where, you know, I don't, writing for me is very much mixed up with that, that I want to be a best-selling writer. That's what I want to do with my writing. I want people to read my stories. But at the same time, as you say, I know that I would still probably write even if I didn't have any chance of that. So I'm not really sure what's driving me. I suppose it brings me back to that I have no idea why people write. I have no idea why I write. And it's very hard to unpack, perhaps. And perhaps, maybe, Joanne, if you're listening to this, maybe she is actually still a little bit more ambitious than she allows herself to believe. She should be with this book.
Yeah, she should be. It's a magnificent book.
Hopefully the people listening to us are getting some joy out of their writing too.
Let's hope so. And let's hope that they get joy from reading Joanne Fedler's latest book, The Whale's Last Song, and also check out her backlist because it really rewards going back to and reading or rereading. And if any of our listeners have got any comments to make on what Jo has said or what we've been talking about, please get in touch. We're on all social media across the board, and we'd love to hear from you.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.